The date is August 6th, 1999, and we're watching Mystery Men. Welcome to I Used to Like This One.
Hello and welcome to I Used to Like This One, the show where we take a look back at movies we remember fondly from our childhood and attempt to look past the nostalgia to see if they still hold up. My name is Sean Wells, and with me, as always, is the Mr. Furious to my shoveler.
Yes. Hello, I'm Colin Stewart. So angry right now. Rage, filling body, can't stop.
And this week, we are, in a sense, celebrating the new Suicide Squad movie by highlighting another movie featuring a ragtag group of heroes, but it's such an obscure group of heroes that we decided we needed a comic book expert. Well, we didn't just get one, we got two. The married co-host team of a podcast that I've discovered and absolutely love called Comic Book Couples Counseling. Please welcome our bowler and blue Raja, Lisa and Brad Gullickson.
Hello!
Hello! Happy to be here. I was going to go with, I am the spleen to Lisa's Captain Amazing.
Okay, there we go.
I did have spleen written down at one point, and I'm like, well, we're just meeting these guys for the first time.
You just can't throw out the spleen.
Exactly.
So, well, yeah. I fart a lot.
Well, so I did mention that you are our comic book experts. Anytime I've tried to explain comic book couples counseling, they kind of look at me and go, huh? So I'm sure you've got it kind of summed down to like a 30-word explanation. Just give us an idea of what goes on your show. Is 30 too low? But, you know, just a brief explanation of what goes on your CBCC podcast.
I think I can do it, Lisa. I think
go,
I can do it.
Give it a go.
All right. So at Comic Book Couples Counseling, what we do is we take an iconic or maybe not even an iconic or a not so iconic comic book couple like Jean Grey, Scott Summers, and we pair them with a self-help relationship book like The Five Love Languages. And we use that self-help book to delve into the good parts of their relationship and the bad parts of the relationship. We try to help them out. And in doing so, we help each other out.
Nailed it. That was very nice. Added a little extra to the beginning, but I think you finished strong, which is what's important.
Stuck the landing.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, we have other types of episodes. We have creator corners where we interview people like Stephen Bissett or Tom Scioli or Daniel Warren Johnson and folks like that.
And then, we try to milk life lessons out of them to better ourselves, of course, as artists and people.
I wish we were recording this Zoom because Lisa did a milking udder situation that was quite adorable.
So Mystery Men is such an obscure reference. It's probably only slightly mainstream because of this movie, but I know that the Mystery Men first kind of came in with the Flaming Carrot comic. You say mainstream and obscure superheroes on your show. What kind of experience do you have with Flaming Carrot or Mystery Men or these guys in general?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, I think the Mystery Men could be covered on Comic Book Couples Counseling, specifically like the relationship I'd like to get into as it's sort of laid out by the film is the Shoveler and his wife, like that domestic turmoil that's going on there. But to be honest, you know, I appreciate you calling us experts and, you know, I think we're not too shabby, but I have never read a Flaming Carrot comic from Bob Burden. It's a character that was always on the fringes of my childhood. Like, you know, I was very much a Marvel zombie with some occasional
dalliances
into the DC Comics universe or Image Comics or whatever. But I never touched Flaming Carrot.
Okay.
It is an extremely attractive looking character. And watching Mystery Men, I found myself, you know, getting online and going, you know, it's time to read some Flaming Carrot. And I have now purchased some Flaming Carrot comics, and they're in transit to our love nest. But I must admit that we have no experiences with the characters of the Mystery Men outside of the film.
Okay. And this was my first watch of the film.
Oh, okay.
It came out in 1999. I was in ninth grade at the time, which I think would put me in the window of people who would watch it, but it was not my bag. I grew up in an extremely conservative home, so we didn't get out to the movies very often. If it was not PG or approved of in our local religious newspaper, I didn't get to see it. But I think that that'll actually help this podcast because I'm nostalgia free. So okay. I feel like I don't have any kind of rose colored childhood glasses. Really haze my vision of this very dated, though charming film.
And while Lisa was in ninth grade, I was a freshman in college. And
so he could do what he wanted.
I did see Mystery Men in the theater, and I loved Mystery Men. And I was one of those jerks who was like, oh, you like The Matrix, huh? Well, you know, the film that I'm really enjoying right now is Mystery Men. I was a little hipster.
What about you guys? What is your history with The Mystery Men?
Well, we'll get there in a second.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, no worries.
Show, Lisa.
I'm just curious.
Well, just to put it into perspective, 3 weeks after this movie came out, my oldest son was born. So I'm not quite a child when I saw this. But this week we are looking back at August 1999 when the movies in theaters were American Pie, The Iron Giant, Deep Blue Sea, Eyes Wide Shut, and of course our movie for today, Mystery Men, which earned $33.5 million on a $68 million budget. Ouch.
That's wow, our... Wow.
That's our second loser on this show after Monster Squad.
Oh,
yeah.
Love and as always, just
a reminder, we will be throwing spoilers at you like the bowler throws her father. So if you haven't seen this movie, like Lisa, actually, and like me for that matter, hit pause, go watch it, and then come back and hear what we have to say.
So the tagline that appears on the poster for this movie is, "This summer, expect the unexpected."
Okay.
In unison, outstanding. The look on your face, Colin, tells me you're not a fan either. I mean, that's the Big Brother tagline.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if the unexpected is that they're just going to be, I guess the unexpected you might expect, but I don't think you would expect that they're going to be great superheroes just by the look of them. So I think you get what you expect.
Well, it's not the best description of this movie. So let's go to Colin and do our 60-second synopsis.
All right, here we go. When the champion of Champion City, Captain Amazing, comes to the realization that he's done his job too well and is without any nemesis with which he can do battle, he uses his alter ego to help gain the release of his longtime foe, Casanova Frankenstein, which is quite possibly the greatest villain name ever, who promptly captures him. Now, it's up to the city's real superheroes, Blue Raja, Mr. Furious, and the Shovel, to save the day. As our heroes contend with the doubting women in their lives, they must also expand the ranks of their supergroup. Will they be able to pull it together in time to save Captain Amazing and stop Casanova Frankenstein before he psycho-fraculates Champion City into oblivion? Let's find out on another episode of I Used to Like This One.
Right on. So yes, Colin, Lisa already asked it, but what is your experience with Mystery Men?
Well, in 1999, I was very much into like highbrow comic films such as Batman Forever and Batman and Robin. So I saw the trailer for Mystery Men and felt like they were making fun of everything that I held dear and chose to boycott it. So I actually hadn't watched it until this week.
Well, what's funny is I did read that a lot of the sets were recycled from Batman Forever.
Yeah. I found like even the opening credits, the way that this movie opens is very reminiscent of the Schumacher Batman movies, where it's like the clouds and then the bat symbol would form and there'd be lightning in the background and whatever, and then it'd all float away to reveal Gotham City. And that's pretty much the exact same way they open Mystery Men.
I have a lot of vigorous nodding coming from Brad's screen over there.
That's why I mean, like, it's one of the charms that the film has is how it recycles Batman Forever's sets, And, you know, that opening credit sequence does feel like we are dipping into Gotham City, or and specifically, mm-hmm. as you said, you know, Schumacher's Gotham City.
Yeah.
And so, like, I get a little giddy seeing all of that stuff and then seeing them awkwardly shift other types of sets into it. And the clash of production design that occurs in Mystery Men is awkward, but also delightful, charming. You know, I like it.
Yeah. So even the opening scene where they're at that ball and the red eyes come in is so similar to the opening scene of Batman and Robin with Mr. Freeze.
Yeah.
That I was like, is it just supposed to be a straight ripoff, or is it its own thing?
And that the head red eye guy is Artie Lang of all people.
Yeah, how fun is that?
Very strange. Very strange. Artie Lang and Tom Waits hanging out in the same room. Wow.
I love how no matter what the group of people is in the late 90s and early aughts, it doesn't matter if it's an old folks home or a library. It's always a rave. It's always a rave. People are rubbing up against each other. Take an E, I assume. Having a great time.
Yeah, I know for me, this is one of those movies that I didn't see until it was on video. And it was back when I worked at video stores. And it was just one of those ones that, okay, we have enough copies of this. I might as well see what the problem is, or what the problem is. Whoops, that's a slip of the tongue. What the hype is. Because at the time, I was a big Ben Stiller fan. I mean, we had There's Something About Mary, and like, he was the hot new thing. So that's for me. It was just one of those that I picked up, and it was, that happened.
I mean, for me, this was coming off of Fargo, right? And I was like hardcore Coen Brothers fan. Okay. And when I heard that William H. Macy was playing a character called the Shoveler in Ben Stiller's new superhero film, I was like, well, I'm on board. I can't wait to watch that. And like I said, I was really into this movie at the time. I was one of its champions.
Yeah. And I know I read that Janine Garofalo signed on because she found out William H. Macy was cast, him and Jeffrey Rush. And she's like, okay. She had turned it down originally, but then decided, no, you know what? Those two are involved. This has got to be some good shit. Well, okay, let's jump into Mystery Men. It's directed by Kinka Usher, who plays Mo in the movie. I don't know who Mo was.
Yeah, I don't remember that character.
He was probably in one of the like weird gangs, like the Warriors like gangs.
Yeah, because that's where people like Michael Bay show up in a cameo, and CeeLo Green for some reason.
Yeah, and Han from the Fast and the Furious movies. Sung Kang is one of the Suzies.
Oh, okay.
What?
That, yeah, like I was scrolling through IMDb and I saw Sun Kang's name and I was like, hold up, what? And then sure enough, I had to rewind the movie and he is one of the Suzies.
He looks glamorous.
I mean, he looks very glammed out, but you have to really squint to see him.
Nice. Well, for Kinka Usher, this is his only feature directing credit. He's a commercial guy. And apparently he said after this movie, I'm going back to commercial.
You can't just discount that he's a commercial guy. He did Got Milk. Yeah. And he did No Kiro Taco Bell.
But I've read that there's an urban legend going around that says Tim Burton secretly directed this movie. But
oh, really?
Yeah.
I love that idea, but I mean, I just can't imagine this being the quality that it is if Tim Burton actually touched it at any point. Now, I could imagine Ben Stiller kind of pseudo-directing it, but I also read that rumor, I think it was the IMDb trivia at the halfway point, and I just started to watch it. I was like, it just doesn't feel like a Tim Burton movie in any way, especially of this era.
Yeah, I was going to say, Tim Burton, I don't think he cannot do Tim Burton. And this movie, like, other than some of the sets, which I still think they're just like recycled old Batman sets, everything else doesn't really like feel like him at all.
Yeah.
So I'd have a hard time believing that he directed it.
And like, what would Tim Burton be doing at this point? Was it Sleepy Hollow?
That sounds about right. Yeah.
So Sleepy Hollow was 1999, the same year. No way he had time to go over and shoot a couple shots of Mystery Men. Although I would love that to be proven true.
One of my favorite things that I found about Kinka Usher was his Twitter page.
Ooh.
It's been inactive since 2018, but his bio is just one line, and he just says, "I directed the movie that actually made All Star by Smash Mouth popular."
That's right. I know that as soon as that song came up, that's what I did, is I hopped on my Google machine. I'm like, wait, Shrek is 2000s, right? Yeah. So, movie's produced by Lawrence Gordon, Lloyd Levin, and Mike Richardson, and it's written by Neil Cuthbert, who has some great credits like Pluto Nash and Hocus Pocus and Return of Swamp Thing, and written by Bob Burden, who gets the comic book series credit, and it's his only writing credit on IMDb. So, we open the movie into the pseudo-futuristic city called Champion City, and we already mentioned that it's like a very Schumacher-type aerial view that we get into the city. But my first question, and I mean, hopefully you know enough about Mystery Men, Brad, or Lisa, is the fact that, what is the backstory with Champion City? Because as we go around the city, there's clearly a big Japanese influence, as well as some Russian, and then on top of it, what year is it?
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like, again, I have no idea. And I know Lisa doesn't have any idea.
I'm Googling furiously.
With Champion City. But it does feel like a Gotham-like city where it has some hints of New York and Chicago in it.
But also Blade Runner, weirdly.
But then Blade Runner, right? So, like, they are trying to put a bit of a 1984 sheen on it, like an Orwellian sheen on it, and some of the stuff really lands well for me, like Captain Amazing, like branding out his entire uniform, like he's a NASCAR driver. Like it, I love all that stuff. But then you go to like Claire Forlani. How do you say her name?
Forlani.
So you go to her diner, and it's, you know, a throwback diner with no hints really of these other eras. So it is a confusing place, but again, I think that lends to its charm.
Yeah, because even mentioning the diner is the fact that they have like those pay video screens on the table, almost like mini jukeboxes would have in those old diners. You know, I'm thinking Johnny Rockets, you know, those throwback 50 diners, you know?
Oh, yeah. I've been to a few of those in my day. It kind of reminds me, like, it's not even pushed as far as the diner in Back to the Future Part 2 in the 2015 sequence.
Yeah.
Like, they are playing with nostalgia, but they're also not obvious that they're playing with nostalgia. It's just strange.
Yeah, it's still seedy and 80s looking.
Yeah.
It reminds me of Edge City in The Mask.
Okay,
where it's just kind of like, it has that mix of some things look old, some things look new. Some things look futuristic to just kind of make it timeless, I guess, might be the goal.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned The Mask. And, you know, Mike Richardson, one of the producers on this from Dark Horse Comics, you know, at this time, Dark Horse was having a lot of success bringing their adaptations to the screen. So not only did you have Mystery Men, but you had The Mask. You had Jean-Claude Van Damme's Time Cop. Mm-hmm. You had Pamela Anderson's Barbed Wire. So, like, Mike Richardson was... He was like, I'm making the cinematic universe now. It's going to happen. Yeah. And then all of them came out. He got them to theaters, but none of them sort of exploded. No. Well, they exploded in a different way.
Like Mr. Spleen.
Okay, well, let's talk about our three core mystery men. We've got Mr. Furious / Roy, played by Ben Stiller, The Shoveler, played by William H. Macy, and Blue Raja, played by Hank Azaria. So, are these three in the comics? Do you know?
Yes. So I was looking it up. So those three are in the comics, and you know, Captain Amazing is not. And I Casanova Frankenstein is from the books.
Okay.
But I believe that's it. And then everyone else is sort of imagined.
Okay.
Yeah, they're part of the Flaming Carrots, like Justice, like the Mystery Men. I think from what I read, it's like the Mystery Men show up. Not in, like, the Flaming Carrot proper, but in, like, flashbacks to, like, his, like, initial adventures, kind
of. Yeah, my understanding is that they are sort of stand-ins for the Justice Society of America from DC Comics.
Yeah.
Mr. Furious is Wildcat, and the Shoveler is...
Jay Garrick's
the Flash. And then who would the Roger be?
Green Lantern.
Green Lantern, Alan Scott. Yeah, so... Yeah. Interesting.
I mean, I will say that The Shoveler is definitely my favorite one. I mean, maybe it's just because William H. Macy, But I just like his earnestness with, you know, like, God yeah. gave me a gift. I shovel well. You know, he's just such a great one.
Watching the film, for me, I kind of wished the focus had been on him instead of Mr. Furious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that domestic drama that is happening at home where his wife is like sick and tired, like, you've been doing this for years. I need you to be a husband. And he's like, I've got a gift. I have to protect the city. And, you know, what's the point of coming home if there's going to be no home to come back to? Like, that scene where it suddenly becomes like this Douglas Sirk melodrama, like, ooh, more of that. Give me that movie. And then you head on over to Mr. Furious and his diner gal. And it's just like, no, this is no good. None of this. Give me none of this.
Yeah. I think conceptually it was a strong choice to have the shoveler as this foil for Mr. Furious, because Eddie truly believes in his gift and mm-hmm. he understands that it is taking away from his family life, but he really does feel called to do what he does because it is his talent. But he also seems to really value his friendship with Roy,
yeah.
and he doesn't want to step on Roy's toes. So Roy wants to be this leader and he wants to be this cool guy, but he doesn't really actually literally believe in him, in his powers and in himself or in his teammates.
Yeah.
And so to have Eddie step in at the end of the story as like a leadership needs to happen, and he just naturally steps in and fulfills that role. And through that, the other characters seem to fall into place, I think was a truly beautiful thing. And then to watch Roy learn from that and go like, well, maybe the leadership role is not exactly where I fit in. I think that is like, I think the idea is so great.
Mm-hmm. That reminds me a lot of, that was very well put, but anyways, but what it reminds me a lot of is the 90s X-Men cartoon
and the way that
Cyclops and Wolverine are played off each other, because they also very much have that relationship where it's like Wolverine wants to be the leader, but he can't be the leader because he's just the like hothead, whatever. And then I remember hating Cyclops when I was a kid, but he's clearly the better leader. Yeah. But they have a very similar dynamic.
Well, I know throughout this movie I get heavy Tick vibes. That's my bigger comparison with this, is that so many of the characters with these kind of off-brand Avengers and off-brand Justice League, it's the Tick that it reminds me of big time.
But the reason it doesn't reach the Tick level is because Ben Stiller is not really in touch with what makes him funny, I feel like, in yeah. this film.
Well, I mean, I would say that the film is struggling tonally, and probably the filmmakers, the producers, the actors, the director don't necessarily all agree on what kind of comic book movie they're making. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have like, well, it's sort of like the Tick. But if you want Mystery Men that is good, go watch the Tick cartoons, the mm-hmm. Tick, the multiple Tick TV series,
yeah.
and read the Tick comics. Those 12 books are amazing.
Yeah,
I'd be curious for you, Brad, like, because you watched this movie when you were younger. Does that change? Like, I think if I would have watched Mystery Men when I was in high school, I would have gravitated more to Mr. Furious. Like, I would have thought he was, you know, maybe funnier and a little bit more of the standout. But watching it now, I agree with you guys. Like, I'm just like, I think the shoveler should have been more of the focal point.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I really would love to go back in time and talk to 1999 Brad, because yeah. I'm trying to figure out why I loved it as much as I did on the rewatch. Not that I hated it, but like, I find the movie very baffling, and I find even more baffling how much in love with this movie I was. Mm-hmm. And I think it stems from, it was an excuse for me to celebrate William H. Macy, who I thought I was like, I was, you know, because of Fargo, I was like, I know this guy. This
I discovered
guy,
him.
I discovered this guy because of Fargo. And then, you know, Ben Stiller at the time, you know, that was not only Something About Mary, but the Ben Stiller Show. I was really into the Ben Stiller sketch comedy show as well. Yeah. And so you felt like you were part of, not the cool kids club, but like the hipster kids club, you know, while people were celebrating the more spandexy stuff, I could go like, well, you know, Mystery Men's commenting on all of that. And it's pointing out yeah. what makes those things great and stupid. Mm-hmm. I guess that's what young Brad would have said. I don't know.
I think what appealed to young people, if I were to guess, and also what kind of spoils the movie in my opinion, is they try to maintain some aspirationalness to Mr. Furious, where he does kind of look cool and he does have this super hot diner chick who is inexplicably into him for no reason. And then he gets this message of like, you just need to truly be yourself. And then it's like, oh, I was wrong. You are super cool. Yourself is a leather jacket and rage. You know, I think that to like, they were trying to maintain this, like, he's cool. He just doesn't know that he's cool. When what would have been a really more beautiful and more substantial, long-lasting message is like, you're not cool. You're not different than the spleen or Invisible Boy. And guess what? That's okay.
Yeah,
like, you know, like, I think the message should have been, you don't actually belong in the Mystery Men. You are just Roy, and you should just go off with Monica if she's into you for some reason.
Like, I think it wants to celebrate the weirdos. You know, it wants to do kind of like that Revenge of the Nerds thing, but it never has the courage
to be weird enough.
Well, to be weird, but to like to be a little honest and mean towards these characters. Like, I think these characters deserve a little bit more of a beating than they get. Narratively. Not physically.
Well, on that note, like, what do we think of Blue Raja? Is he okay?
I feel so bad for Hank Azaria.
Do you? I don't know if I feel bad.
I don't know if I feel bad for giving the Apu thing.
Yeah,
I think that he discovered he could do this thing. People asked him to do it again and again, and he got so much money for it. And it turns out that it's a really wrong thing to do, and he didn't know. I just see that he is a guy tripping over his own shoelaces because he was not woke in 1997.
I don't know if I would say that I feel sorry for him. I think I understand him in the way that I understand my grandpa who cannot figure out culture today.
Yeah.
But the Blue Raja is a perfect character to talk about how they mishandled it. Thankfully, he's not actually doing brown face in the film, as I first thought when I was rewatching it.
I was like, oh no.
And so when it starts to like mock him a little bit for putting on this persona, that's a character that I think like they could have been a little harsher towards. He could have had a much larger revelation about what he is doing with this persona. But again, in 1999, I mean, they don't even realize the problematicness of it all.
Yeah. I was shocked that he never, like, that doesn't become a thing. Like, he just leaves the movie as Blue Raja, and they'll just continue on.
You know, there is an explanation. Like, have you ever had one of those Halloween costumes that you have to explain? Like, I remember one year when one of my best friends, we went trick-or-treating, and he was the Noid. And everyone, whenever we got to the door, they would be like, oh, you're a red rabbit. No, I'm the Noid, you know, the pizza guy. And that's how the Blue Raja comes across to me, is he's this guy that he can justify the reason for this costume, but he always has to explain it. And it's like, you might as well just change the costume, because really, forks don't have anything to do with a Raja either, right? Like,
that's what I like about it, because he is that guy. But the lesson should have been, you have to explain it, you have to explain it, you have to explain it. Oh, crap, I shouldn't be explaining this at all because I shouldn't be this thing.
Right, of course. I did like his emotional apex where he tells his mother, who has been so disapproving of him being in his room all the time, and he believes that she would disapprove of him. But when he finally tells her what he's up to, she's like, that is so beautiful and so admirable. And I'm so proud of you for finding something so special to do. I really liked that as a plot point in the context of the greater narrative of this story.
But still manages to get that dig in there of, I guess you're not going to get married. I might as well give you the silver now.
Right. Yeah, of course. I mean, there's a ton of super awkward sexism,
gay panic.
Yeah. Like, that's very cringy. Like, I would not show this to
I mean, it's of the era.
Yeah. In a way that I think is kind of inexcusable.
Yeah.
And I don't quite understand why he doesn't wear blue if he's the Blue Raja. Did he just get he managed to find this turban that was green, and it's like, well, Blue Raja just comes off the tongue better or something?
Yeah, I don't know.
I think you should have just like used foul language. Then you would be the Blue Raja.
Now, also, our third mystery man, Roy, Mr. Furious, Yeah, and like we said, I don't really understand why he's the leader, but I wonder, how often do you think Ben Stiller went home with headaches at the end of the day?
I would love if I ever got into a room with Ben Stiller, I would only talk to him about Mystery Men. It's the only movie of his that I have serious questions about. And the stories around the production of this movie and, you know, how he was initially like approached to direct it and he turned it down. And he had like some spats with Greg Kinnear on the set, apparently. Like, yeah. I'm sure he was losing his mind on this film. In addition to having to go full rage mode and probably bust several blood vessels every time he had to act to camera. But that being said, like, I think, you know, Mr. Furious is another character where a few tweaks would have made him very interesting. Like, I think Mr. Furious is the perfect analog for an incel-like character. We could explore that impotent rage in a very interesting way that the film touches on, but ultimately kind of leaves on the floor.
I think the first punch up would be to remove the character of Monica.
Yeah,
I think agree. That she's a distraction. It's confusing and not done. It's just not done well. And I think that.
And I love her. I love her. But
really, it is a romance movie, but it's a romance between a man and his friends.
Yeah.
And it's really a story about how can we learn to truly trust each other to strengthen each other as a team is what this movie is really about.
I was curious, like as I watched the movie, like how furious is Mr. Like, is his rage real?
Yeah, because like the bus that they talk about, like, is that a true story that he actually moved a bus?
Well, there's the bus, but even like when he's talking to that shopkeeper and he has to pick up the stress ball to calm himself down.
Yeah,
like I don't believe for a second that he would have ever attacked her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I don't either. I like my reading on it is that he probably had a moment, and it was probably with that bus, where they were like, oh, calm down, Mr. Furious. And for a guy who has always wanted to be kind of a part of this superhero culture that surrounds Captain Amazing, he saw an in. He's like, I can channel my rage. And when he then became the guy who could channel his rage, he then had to continually justify it in encounters.
I think he just had bad boy aspirations and he wasn't really a bad boy.
Yeah.
It's like the same thing when Monica goes like, what's your real name? And he's like, it's Phoenix, you know, Phoenix Dark.
Phoenix Dark, yeah.
Appreciate the reference.
I think that, you know, he wants to be Wolverine or the Crow and he's just not
or the Crow. I don't know. I really like Brad's take on it though, the idea of the whoa, Mr. Furious, let's, you know, slow down there. I like to think that, you know, that is now headcanon for me of that's how he got the name. But you mentioned Captain Amazing. Let's talk about the man himself, the hero that all these others aspire to be, Captain Amazing, played by Greg Kinnear. I almost feel like this is what Homelander from The Boys might have been like before he got like all power crazy and psychotic.
I agree. I think he is like a proto Homelander. I think he's like it's a really top notch idea in that scene where he, you know, he saves the day in the old folks home and then Ricky Jay comes and collects him as his publicist. And they, you know, they learn that he learns from the press that Pepsi has dropped him like the white collar capitalist rage that shivers through his performance, I think is like really, really on point. I think it really works. It's an interesting concept.
And the fact that he's such an effective hero and he discovers he's essentially putting himself out of business.
Yeah.
And he makes this realization of, oh, I need to re-release one of my supervillains so that I can reestablish my dominance. Yeah. I think it's such like an intriguing
plot. Yeah, and not to spoil The Boys, the Amazon series, but Homelander kind of does something similar.
Yeah. I mean, just, yeah, the whole idea of he's bored. So that's the crux of the movie. That's why the whole plot takes place is because he's simply bored. But what are Captain Amazing's powers? Because, like, he uses a jetpack to fly, which I read uses the same sound effect as the turbine engine from Adam West's Batmobile.
Right.
But, yeah, like, is he super strong? Is he bulletproof?
I mean, he's clearly super strong in the fight
yeah.
in the old folks home, every time he kicks or punches somebody, they go flying. But I wasn't sure what other powers he had other than that.
I, in my mind, imagined him like an evil Bruce Wayne, where he uses technology. You know, that suit probably grants him stuff, and that his actual superpower is his wealth.
Yeah, he's a person of privilege.
Yeah, and again, like let's explore that. I want to see more of that.
Well, yeah, and I have to say, one of my favorite things about Captain Amazing is how terrible his secret identity is. Because I know I listened to your guys' tribute to Richard Donner, where you talked about Superman the movie, and some of the things that you had to say about Clark Kent versus Superman, that's always been my favorite aspect of Superman, is the bumbling. Like, everyone thinks it's just the glasses. No, it's the posture, it's the character, it's everything. But I love how Lance is just Captain Amazing with glasses. Literally just Captain Amazing with glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone is fooled anyway. Like, later on when he tells them, Lance is Captain Amazing, and they're like, no, no. Like, they don't even believe him when he says it.
I love the moment when he goes into Casanova Frankenstein's parole hearing. And he's like, I have a message here from my good friend, Captain Amazing. Yeah. And you get it, and he gives this really impassioned reading of this letter. And then you see that it's just his, like, his shopping list.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, of course, it's the Spider-Man thing of, like, why does Peter Parker always have, like, these amazing shots of Spider-Man? Like, I just thought that was so fun. Oh, I got a phone call from my very good friend, Captain Amazing.
Yeah, and I think Greg Kinnear is having a ball with this performance.
Greg Kinnear is so underappreciated. I love that guy. I even loved him on Talk Soup. I thought he did a great job.
Yep, same.
But I do need to address something, which is Captain Amazing's outfit. Because, like Brad said earlier, it's covered in advertising, just like a NASCAR driver, and I think I need to discuss that advertising in Sponsorship Corner! So, always on the lookout for product placements in movies, this week, Mystery Men is brought to you by Pepsi, Rayovac, Pennzoil, Team ASE, which is Automotive Service Excellent, Jiffy Lube, Reebok, Konica, Gum Out, and two, I'm not sure if they're real, Shofar Foods and The Outlaw. Those are all the ones on Captain Amazing's costume. It's also brought to you by Miller Lite, Best Foods, Real Mayonnaise, The Bee Gees, Chevrolet, Dodge, American Motors Rebel, and Messerschmitt KR200 Carbine Cabin Roller Cars. Plus the fictional Lakeside Diner, Mighty Whitey Toothpaste, Sally's Auto Dismantlers, Hop Louie Restaurant, the Herkimer Motor Vehicle, Tradio Radio, Vizmat, and Cavalier Pay TV, and one that I can't totally tell if it's real or fake from Googling, Jersey Made Chocolate Milk. And finally, something that I don't understand, but found tremendously hilarious, in the credits, there is a note at the end that says, Dockers khakis are the official khakis of Champion City.
Amazing.
I don't know what to make of it, but this has been Sponsorship Corner. So is Captain Amazing the true villain of this movie? Because of the fact that he uses his position to get Casanova Frankenstein released?
Yes, but he has the most epic death scene that I really enjoyed on this rewatch. I had completely forgotten that death, and his fury at having to communicate with these dimwits on releasing him and how it leads to his, you know, execution at the hands of the Blue Raja felt like a very fitting end for this a-hole.
Yeah.
It was so good. And the effect, like a lot of those like stop motion feeling effects in this film are so fun. Well, and that death was so rad.
Like, because it's like this CGI morphing situation going on there, but like the statue, the puppet or whatever that was left over.
The charred corpse.
The charred corpse. And when Janine Garofalo checks its pulse and its hand breaks off, it's upsetting and funny.
And so moot.
Yeah, and so
moot. Yeah. I love it.
Well, and I love the logic games that are going on in the background there, too, where it's like, okay, wait, You said flip it again, but we've already flipped it twice. So is this a third time? Where is there a reset button? Like, let's just back up. But I have to say that there's no way that those arm restraints were actually holding Captain Amazing in place. There was a good, like, inch of air around there. Take off your gloves, Captain Amazing. You can slip your hands right out of there. Break a thumb, for God's sake. You know?
Is that one willing to make the sacrifice play, even of a thumb?
No.
Yeah. So, okay, let's meet the rest of the team. First, Spleen, played by Paul Rubens, who is the member that just kind of inserts himself into the team, whether they want him or not. But I have to say, the Spleen was far funnier than that character had any right to be.
Yes.
Like am I just that much of a sucker for fart jokes? But, like, come on. You know, the silent but deadly. You
know, like, Lisa and I had a conversation about this while we were watching it. Like, I love Paul Rubens. I've always loved Paul Rubens. Pee-wee Herman was, like, a childhood icon for me. Mm-hmm. And I do think, like, when you hear this character, and when he first appears and he's got all the acne, you're like, oh, this is going to be bad. This is going to be bad. Yeah. But he sells it. And the gags around the farts are not terrible.
They're pretty funny. Good. And I do enjoy the origin story of him blaming a fart on a powerful stranger. I found that really, really charming. And I think that he still imbues the character with a lot of heart.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
a
lot of fart.
I know. I know what you mean about Paul Rubens, because for some reason, there's a joke that always sticks out in my mind, and it's a Paul Rubens moment. And it was after he went to prison for his whole, you know, public masturbation issue.
Yeah.
And the first award show that he did, he came out onto stage and his first line was, "Heard any good jokes lately?" I mean, it's just something that just sticks out in my head.
Like, so good.
Yeah, all I can think is, I've heard Bill Cosby wants to go out on tour now that he's out. Oh, God. If he's going to steal any joke, though, that's got to be the one that he steals right there. Is if anyone actually books that man, he has to come out with, "Heard any good jokes lately?" Because it actually worked for Paul Rubens. Maybe you can rosy up your image there, Bill Cosby, but probably not.
The crimes are entirely different.
Yeah. You know, like Paul Rubens, you know, and that was one of the reasons why people thought Tim Burton was involved with Mystery Men, because of the Paul Rubens appearance, because Tim Burton, you know, put him into Batman Returns and of course, you know, Pee Wee's Big Adventure is a Tim Burton movie.
Yeah.
And I would say the best Tim Burton movie, Lisa. So, you know, more Paul Rubens.
Oh, over Big Fish? Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Ed Wood, I might hear an argument for Ed Wood, but other than that.
But with the Spleen, even the skunk humping scene, like at first I rolled my eyes, but when Invisible Boy says, "Just go with it, man," and he starts swaying back and forth, like I started chuckling, like all
and that shot, the shot of Invisible Boy and the Spleen silhouetted by this giant cartoonish moon as a skunk humps his leg. That's a gorgeous shot. It might be the most beautiful shot in the entire film.
Oh, yeah, it is a nice shot. I agree. And then we go recruiting, and first we go to track down Invisible Boy, who is played by Kel Mitchell. I love the introduction where he says, "Hey, Dad, I'm going to my room with three strange men."
Yeah. I didn't realize that was Kel for probably the first 40 minutes he was on screen. I thought for sure it was Cisco.
Oh,
same. I did too. Because when he came on screen, I was like, "Is that Cisco?" And then I went to IMDb and I was like, "Kel, oh my goodness."
Oh my goodness. I am so proud of both of those boys, Keenan and Kel. And it's another, he gives another Paul Rubens style performance where it's just like a tremendously grounded performance of this like ridiculous character. Mm-hmm. And I think that he encapsulates the best the storyline of believing in yourself and trusting those around you imbues you with so much power. And I found his moment of heroism where he became invisible, and weirdly also he had an extra element of his power, which was he became naked for some reason.
Yeah.
I thought it was so, so fun.
Yeah. why did his clothes fall off his body? So he becomes invisible and
incorporeal.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
I think he's the most powerful of them all.
Interesting.
And then, of course, Janine Garofalo's delivery of maybe you want to put some shorts on if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Yeah, with William H. Macy backing it up with two hands, son.
Great.
That was one thing I found I wasn't too sure about in the movie for a while was, do people actually have powers? Like, clearly Invisible Boy and the bowler do. Well, but I wasn't even
sure. But
the
bowler doesn't. I mean, well, except she can talk to him, but like all the power comes from her dad as far as I can
but
tell.
But I mean, it is supernatural.
There's, yeah, there's like an element of the supernatural. Like, okay. I wasn't confident necessarily with the spleen that he didn't just have some terrible gastrointestinal problem. and then even with like all the, some of the people who show up to try out and stuff, they all just seem like DIY, like,
yeah,
real life superheroes. So it's, I thought it was kind of inconsistent sometimes with who is a real superhero and who is not. Like, they mentioned the Human Torch when they're in mm-hmm. the... I would be curious to know what their version of the Human Torch
the
was.
The Flaming Carrot.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but also...
I think it's like the banquet scene in another 90s classic, Hook, where they're pretending to have powers so hard that their powers do in fact become real.
But like, I mean, okay. I agree with Colin that at one point you're going like, well, are these guys just escapees from their parents' basements who are doing whatever they can to have abilities? And for a lot of the movie, you know, I also was trying to figure out if they had legit superhero abilities. Yeah. But then when Janine Garofalo shows up, and clearly there's, like, when she throws the ball for the first time and it goes all over the place, you're like, okay, well, something actually happened there. And then yeah. Invisible Boy turning invisible and intangible proves that there was powers there. But I feel like that was an element that they could have
played up more.
Yeah, played up yeah. more. Yeah.
Yeah, how many of them are just vigilantes and how many of them have powers? Because Sphinx's yeah. introduction as well,
yeah.
he disassembles everybody's gun with his mind. So he has powers too.
That's right.
Because I was just thinking, even with how you were talking before about Captain Amazing, like, he might not actually be Superman. He might just be, like, somewhere between Tony Stark and Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
Like, his gauntlets might be what give him extra strength.
Maybe.
I don't know that he's, like, some kind of alien. Like, his backstory isn't really ever explained.
Yeah. Let's talk about that audition scene. You brought it up. I have to say that the audition montage for me is equal parts some of the funniest moments and some of the cringiest.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Entirely.
There were a lot of moments that, you know, looking back now, were just, they're unfortunate. Like, I love Dane Cook as the Waffler. Yeah, and I read that he was told to bring in his own costume and he came back with that grill mark shirt and he has the waffle iron in his hand. And he was told, no, it was supposed to be Waffler, like, can't make a decision. But, like, his, I'm the Waffler! I love. But then it's just followed up with Ballerina Man, who the joke is all, ha-ha, it's a man in a tutu.
Yeah. Right?
Or we've got Doug Jones's Pencilhead and yeah. Son of Pencilhead. But then the PMS Avenger was yeah. a little uncomfortable, like, and of course the two Wonder Women that get into a fight and it's just all yeah. of a sudden it just stops because it's ooh, chick fight, and I mean they're all pervertedly watching. I'll admit I've never understood how a chick fight is hot to begin with, but it just,
I'll explain it on another podcast at some point for you.
Oh, but
the my favorite cameo in there, of course, is Doug Jones. You know, we cherish Doug Jones over
oh,
here
doesn't?
At Comic
yeah.
Book Couples Counseling, but also Dana Gould as
yeah.
Squeegee Man.
A big 90s stand-up comedy nerd, I love that little cameo.
And you literally, you have to pry your eye open for the shot to last. Like, the shot is so short and so small that he flies on by. But I was happy for a split second.
Fun.
Yeah.
Nice.
I also love how before they start this audition process, the shoveler's wife is just like, well, no one better puke in the pool. And then at the end of the auditions, they're sitting around and they're just throwing shit in the pool. how many times should the shoveler's wife have left him in this movie? Because every time it's, if you're going to come home late, I'm leaving. Or if you continue with this, I'm leaving. Like, she threatens at least four times, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And again, like, I love all of that stuff. And I wanted more of it. I love their relationship.
Yeah. But the auditions get them nowhere, and so they're getting to the point of packing it in, and that's when the bowler shows up, played by Janine Garofalo. I read that her father, coincidentally, Janine Garofalo's real father, he's named Carmine as well.
That's so fun.
Yeah, and I was wondering, like, I wonder if he was named Carmine in the comic, or whether they just decided to invent this name and honor him in a way.
I don't think the bowler is from the comic. Yeah.
Okay. I know for sure Invisible Boy isn't. I did read that he's 100% made up.
Yeah, I think the only three that are the three main guys.
See, I thought I saw something that said the Spleen was in the comic.
He might be. Looking at my Wikipedia, it does appear that the bowler is for the film only.
Okay. Okay. And I also read that apparently her parents met in a bowling alley, which is also kind of funny. One of those neat little things that I read in my fun facts.
I do like Janine Garofalo quite a bit in the movie.
I think that all of her exchanges with the bowling ball are really funny. And she does get some really great lines in this movie.
Except for one. There you is go ahead. One where she says, "No, Dad, he's not a commie or a fruit." There is that one line where it's just, well, it's 1999. But she does have some great exchanges. I agree 100%.
And I like the moment at the end where she is talking to the news people and she says, you know, support independent.
Independent film.
And local bands.
Bookstores.
Yeah. Pretty great.
So good. And I like the idea that now that she's had her revenge, she's going to go back to grad school.
Yeah.
So I thought that was great.
Well, I forgot that the ball came back because as soon as the ball goes down the tunnel, my first thought was, well, I guess she's lost her powers now. So I hope that was all the revenge she needed.
But maybe she didn't want those powers, you know, like maybe she wanted to go to grad
school. She's stuck with that dad.
Yeah.
She's cursed like the Ghost Rider or something.
That's right.
I love that now that they're a complete team, their first mission is basically just to vandalize Casanova Frankenstein's car. Like, they're so proud of their victory after this.
I was so mad at the bowler because the Spleen trapped a really deadly fart inside that limo, and then the bowler broke out the window. So it's like, right? Don't do that. You had victory in your hand.
But I also had to laugh just at the fact that Mr. Furious is doing no damage whatsoever, and the shoveler is coming by and just putting in all these amazing dents in the side of the car. I did read that using a shovel as a weapon was something that was taught in World War II, because you'd have them out there digging their foxholes, and they had to know how to defend themselves with a shovel just in case they couldn't get to their gun or their bayonet in time. So it's kind of like, oh, well, there is actually a history for this. So
I love it. I want more of that character.
Just a spin-off movie. Maybe. Just the shoveler.
I could see somebody making like a reboot.
Oh, yeah.
Reboot of not necessarily the Mystery Men, but just of the shoveler.
Yeah. I mean, I would love a Flaming Carrot movie. Again, there I know really nothing about that character, but the profile, the image of Flaming Carrot is so intriguing. And then, you know, toss in the supporting players of the Mystery Men, filling out the backstory, the flashback sequences of that comic. Yeah, I want that World War II shoveler.
And then, of course, after that first mission, they go to have celebratory Chinese, where I think it's like the first time we really get to see them as a team and really get to experience some of their dynamic, especially between the bowler and Blue Raja. There's like something flirty going on.
Well, and then there's also the moment between the bowler and Spleen when Spleen moves over next to her, and not in a million years.
Not for all the beer in the world.
Yeah. So this celebration, I mean, it gets them in trouble because they end up encountering the Disco Boys on the way home when they're all tipsy.
And now, this was a joke. The Disco Boys was a joke that worked for me every time. I thought every time I saw them in their outfits with that really wonderful disco music playing, I was like, yes.
Yeah, every time they showed up and disco was playing on the soundtrack, I delighted it. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, and Eddie Izzard is just one of those guys I love anytime he shows up in something. Yes. Yeah, so
she shows up in something.
Because Eddie Izzard goes by she, her pronouns now.
Ah, okay. But this is also our introduction of Sphinx.
Yes.
Yeah, so now we've added a bit more diversity to the team as well, which is kind of nice. Thank you, 1999, for doing a little something. But I definitely love the Sphinx and how he speaks in riddles that sound profound until you think about them, like Roy does. You know, he who questions training only trains in asking questions. And so, like, every time Ben Stiller finishes one of his sentences for him, I thought it was hilarious.
Yeah, that's a nice touch.
As a person who loves affirmations, though, at first I was like, that does sound really good to me.
I think some of them you could take and apply, even if they are nonsensical, Lisa.
But I think that the crux of the film for me is that moment when they are doing the, like, the chanting, I believe in my powers. I believe in my powers. I believe in the powers of my teammates. Or I believe in the powers of my team. Where it shows that as much as they could show confidence in themselves, they were kind of skeptical of each other's talents.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until they were unified in mission that they could finally support each other. And I thought having this outlet to really... The training montage where it actually pulls Roy up more further from the team than with the team is, I think, really interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, when they are doing that training montage and all doing some seamstressing, I do wonder later on, how does Roy get a costume? Because he was like, fuck that, no.
No, I'm out of here.
They shouldn't have made him a costume.
I mean, yeah. But he did know what a thimble is and is for. So
maybe he was doing it on the side.
Yeah, he was lone wolf seamstressing. Seamstering.
And of course, that training montage using Smash Mouth's All-Star. There we go, right?
Abridged.
Abridged.
Super abridged. It's over before it even starts, it seems like. I was okay with that.
I also don't understand why they don't use their costumes earlier either, because they all go off on that first mission to Casanova Frankenstein's mansion, and they don't wear their new costume. It's only when they get the vehicle at the end and have the big reveal, but still, it feels like maybe they should have altered the edit a little bit.
You know what that is? That's another Schumacher Batman throwback. So, like, they always, for whatever reason, probably just to sell more toys... Always before the final, like, climactic battle, they would get, like, Batman would get some new fancy suit. And Batman Forever, all his suits get destroyed, and they use the one to make Robin's suit. But then he gets this sonar suit, and they go there and they fight. And then in Batman and Robin, they have these, like, ice protector suits that they get. And I feel like, I felt like that part of it. Was similar to the Schumacher Batman ones, because it's also like they pull out the fancy new vehicles, whether it's the Bat boat or the plane or the ice wing thing they have or whatever in Batman and Robin, but it's very similar.
Yeah, like at least Christopher Nolan changes the costume at the beginning of the movie. Did you happen to notice how their team salute keeps changing?
I thought that was fun.
Okay, I just don't understand the reason for it, though.
Because coming up with handshakes is fun.
I thought they had terrible memory.
Okay, so finally, the one other person to meet that plays a key role in these heroes is Doc Heller, played by Tom Waits. I mean, there are several people that we haven't touched on much, like Monica, played by Claire Forlani, or Dr. Annabelle Leak, played by Lena Olin.
So weird.
But yeah, Doc Heller is key to their success because he provides them with all their non-lethal weapons. Which is your favorite? Can Tornado, Shrink Ray, or the Blame Thrower?
Blame Thrower.
Of course. The Blame Thrower is great. Though, and this scene, like, when they first found out that he had non-lethal weapons and they are walking away, my favorite line in the movie happens. I'm hoping it was a Janine Garofalo ad-lib, but, like, this is the argument for your garden variety scientist over a mad scientist. I'm like, yes. So good.
I did read that one improvisation was from The Spleen, because there's the part where they're in the junkyard and there's a flame that bursts up behind him. And he says, uh-huh. Oh, excuse me. And apparently it was just a mistake. They had thrown something into the fire. The crew had thrown something into the fire that just burst up. But without missing a beat, Paul Rubens played with it. So I thought that was it's like when Star-Lord drops the orb in the first Guardians of the Galaxy, you know, one of these flubs that made it into the movie. I always love those honest moments like that.
To me, I wish that the whole film was just a little bit looser. You know, where we got more of these moments where we got to see some genuine inspiration and improvisation. Because I thought at times it did feel a little stiff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because if you're dealing with comedians like Janine Garofalo or Kel Mitchell or Ben Stiller, like, yeah, there should be a little bit more playing around. Paul Rubens is hilarious when he improvises. But Colin, what about you? What was Can Tornado, Shrink Ray, or Blame Thrower for you?
I don't even remember. I feel like I'm blanking on this.
Well, the shrink ray is the one where it shrinks their clothes until they can hardly breathe anymore, which of course gets us another awkward moment later on.
Yeah. To me, I love the idea of it because nobody likes to be in clothes that are too tight. I mean, that would foil me more or less immediately. But the execution of it at the end of the film was not good.
Yeah, followed up with, I think my pants are shrinking too, you know, just to put a button on it. Yeah.
In poor taste.
I have to say, with Heller in that first scene, that's quite the outfit. Like, it's like the 70s threw up on him.
Yeah.
You know? And he looks amazing.
I love it. Yeah. Tom Waits in this film.
He makes everything look cool.
He's fantastic. I enjoy it. You know, I've seen him in several movies, and he doesn't feel the most natural in Mystery Men. It feels like he's struggling at times, and apparently he was struggling to remember lines and whatnot, which gives him some of his most interesting performances. Apparently he was like, he had written his lines on his fingers, and that's why he's like moving his hands in strange ways during one particular scene with the psycho, whatever that device is, the psycho
fraculator.
Yes, psycho fraculator. Right. But like, you know, anytime Tom Waits shows up in a movie, I'm paying attention.
He always brings a magical, mystical element to any film that he's in. Yeah. And I love the fact that he had this ethic of bringing non-lethal weapons. I think that is an interesting spin on the mad scientist. Mm. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, someone does at one point, though, say, Doc, you're a genius. And he replies with, that's what the card says. But I have to say, no, the card does not say that. I paused it. The card says, weapons designer, innovator, inventor, world changer, aromatherapy, laser hair removal, carnival rides, and chicken rentals.
Ooh, chicken rentals.
Which, the bowler has the line, who would want to rent a chicken? And I had the exact same question. What are chicken rentals?
Companionship.
And an emotional support chicken?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. They have a show on Netflix called Pet Stars, where it's talent agents for pets. It's a documentary series, I would say.
Oh, sure.
And people need to rent all kinds of animals, it turns out.
So they get their new vehicle with the electromagnet on top from the scrapyard. As an aside, I will say that there's a calendar in the office of the scrapyard with the date June 31st on it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they drive through the front door of Casanova's mansion. And then this is where Invisible Boy gets into the room. And we also get Captain America-esque line of, you must have ripped the Q section out of my dictionary because I don't know the meaning of quit. This is Mr. Furious's version of, I can do this all day.
And I love that Monica goes like, oh man, when people believe in your powers, you can deliver a quip. I thought that was so nice.
Now, do you feel like the climax of this movie, though, all this bit in the mansion with Mr. Furious climbing up the forks to get to the upper level, and do you feel like it was the climax that this movie, did it build to it properly, do you think?
I feel like everything up until the forks was great, because we got to see directly what they could accomplish when they believed in each other and believed in themselves.
The Invisible Boy moment's good.
The Invisible Boy moment is great.
The shovel fight in the hallway as well shovel is fights. One I like.
Yep.
Really wonderful.
Yep. When he pulls out the spade.
And then he walks up we have that moment where the Blue Raja gives the assist with the walking up the forks. I thought that was brilliant and beautiful. But then we end up with the Mr. Furious fight where he's just like, it's still not very convincing that he has any kind of talent for this.
Yeah. And that's where it should have gone a different way with Mr. Furious. The other fight I do enjoy is with the Susies, who are trying to get the guns off of the electric, the electromagnet. And then the Spleen and Invisible Boy, pull my finger and he aims his farts at their general direction.
Teamwork. That's what it's all about. And I think that that's a really powerful message for young people.
Yeah.
Teamwork makes the dream work, even when your weapon is injured.
Yes. Yes. Bullet in the butt. Played well.
Forrest Gump style. Anything else that anyone wants to add?
We did skip over the egg salad speech and moment.
Oh, that's what, that might be my favorite scene in the movie.
Okay.
And that's when the shoveler has to give the rousing moment, and he's like I could eat this egg salad sandwich, which will kill me, or we could go out and save the world. Because if the world's not going to exist, I might as well just kill myself with this egg salad sandwich, who has so much cholesterol in it. And that speech is all cribbed from Henry V, and it's like, it's a brilliant moment. It's so good. And William H. Macy, this is why you get William H. Macy to deliver this Henry V slanted mystery men rallying cry. So good.
And it inspires his teammates to go and say, goodbye to their loved ones, and leads to some of the most emotional scenes, like the scene with Blue Raja and his mother, even with the, gay panic aside, I think is really wonderful. I do think that while their relationship makes zero sense, there is an effort to give Roy a send off and like that kind of be your true self moment, even though it's completely flipped at the end. But so I think that there was this build to like a moral of this story.
Yeah, I think it fumbles it.
Fumbles.
Yeah.
But that egg salad moment is just so good. Chances are we're already dead.
Did we talk about Casanova Frankenstein? Did I miss that when I was Googling something?
Not a whole lot. Yeah, I mean, I do find it unusual that his pinky nail is his big weapon. But I enjoy the banter when Captain Amazing first shows up at his mansion, where he's telling him to take off the ring and deactivate that other sensor. And I know you've got a knife in your boot and everything like that. And then still gets bested by Casanova Frankenstein. Jeffrey Rush did do a pretty good job in this movie. He was a pretty good villain.
He did a great job. I think that some of his lines were hard to understand because of his accent.
Yeah.
Both him and Eddie Izzard, I feel like we missed out on some of the comedy because I couldn't tell what they were saying. And I generally am pretty good at listening to and for accents. So it was a little disappointing.
I felt like they should have played up more his relationship with his psychiatrist.
Yeah. That was also kind of thrown away, wasn't it?
Yeah. It's so weird because it's Lena Olin, like, the award-winning Swedish actress, an amazing talent. And she has one line. Then every scene she's in afterwards, nothing.
Yeah.
I felt like they had the opportunity to do kind of like a Harley Joker thing where she would be like his right-hand man or woman, and they just kind of cast her aside.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, there we go. That's Mystery Men. Now, Colin, Brad, Lisa, on IMDb, it scored 6.1 out of 10 and has a Metascore of 65. On Rotten Tomatoes, it has 61% on the tomato meter and an audience rating of 57%. But Colin, those are just numbers. Like a shovel to the face. Hit us with some reviews.
Happy to oblige. Okay. From Rotten Tomatoes, Jeremy H. gives this movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, "Wow, what a masterpiece. Every dime of the $68 million was well worth it to make this art. I will show this to my grandkids. When Shovelman said, 'We've got a blind date with Destiny,' and it looks like she ordered the lobster, I knew it was perfect. I honestly can't compare this to other movies. It's just that good. My friends disagree with me, but they're wrong."
That is a great line.
Yeah. Boneyard L gave the movie 3.5 out of 5 stars. He says, "This is one of those strange sleeper films that was too zany for audiences at the time, but has gathered a strong cult following over the years. The humor is a screwball satire of dry comedy and acquired taste, to say the least. The superhero genre has exploded in the 2 decades since this movie came out, and since its story is not an irreverent deconstruction of the genre, but an underdog riff that embraces it, it's only become more relevant over time. On the other hand, its low-fidelity special effects and distinctly 90s directorial style have kept it firmly planted in the past, making it both ahead of its time and stuck in the past. It's an oddball that equals parts great and weird. Closest comparison, it's like The Boys by way of Zoolander.
That works.
Rotten Tomatoes super reviewer Christopher H. says, 3 out of 5 stars, Mystery Men is a fully functional superhero spoof with an above-average comedic cast and a Burton-esque view at the underbelly of a city. Ben Stiller leads the ragtag gang of misfits with special powers, which include wielding a shovel, throwing forks, and flatulation. No one stands out, no one really has a chance to shine, and you could probably think of a handful of better actors that could have knocked these parts out of the park.
Instead.
Except William H. Macy, Brad. Instead, we're left with a completely average action comedy with the self-aware abuse of the genre and a tongue-in-cheek demeanor. Catapulting the song All Star by Smash Mouth, that's about the most memorable element to come out of this film, including a quick but humorous cameo by Dane Cook. And then the last one I have is from Google. Michael Turin gives the movie 5 out of 5 stars and says, this movie is the best movie to ever come to the theaters. The blend of great storytelling and emotional characters make this movie the best in the whole world. Citizen Kane who? Yeah, that's what I thought. This movie is better than any other movie that has came. Sorry, comed before it. Okay. So you had bad grammar and then made it worse. So if this movie got banned, I would choke a newborn child. And then hang myself, because spleen is the goat. And if you think not, then well, you are not the sharpest tool in the shed. Also, the music is the most well handcrafted ever, because who doesn't love Smash Mouth? Yeah, you heard it. The song is Hey Now, so that makes this movie from a 10 out of 10 to an 11 out of 10. So Netflix, if you want to get rid of Hulu and Disney Plus, then make a Mystery Men 2 and you'll be richer than Elon Musk. Or Elon, sorry, he says, you will be richer than Elon's Musk. Thank you for listening to my TED Talk, all caps.
Bravo to that guy.
Oh, man.
Wow.
Somebody hit the hyperbole button on his typing machine.
Well, okay, so we've got kind of low 60s is sort of the average. Let's throw it over to our special guests. I'm excited that one of you has seen it and one of you hasn't. So I look forward to seeing what both of you have to say. Where would this fall for you?
I feel like low 60s is correct. Like, yeah. I think that it's right. There is a lot of 90s charm here. I think the aesthetic is so weirdly, because it is straddling, it's 99, it's straddling the late 90s, the early aughts, the two most embarrassing times in both music and fashion. But we get some really wonderful icons. I love Janine Garofalo. She is the 90s to me, even though some of her later stand-up, most recent stand-up, I think is the most wonderful she's ever done. She's still killing it, by the way. I love Ben Stiller. I love Paul Rubens, even though I'm not the biggest Pee-wee fan, which Brad alluded to. And even though I'd never seen this movie before, it does deliver a lot of nostalgia for me. I also do like the ideas that are presented, the idea of what it means to believe in yourself, how you can be empowered when those around you also believe in you, what you can accomplish when you really truly show your love for your teammates. I think that that's wonderful. But I do think that narratively, it fumbles the ball. I think that the whole Monica romance plot was a complete distraction and detracted from the entire rest of the film. I think that it really sets expectations high with the character of Captain Awesome. I've already forgotten his name.
Captain Amazing,
with this idea of, oh, it's really about like how capitalism is so toxic that people can't even do good without doing bad. I think that that's such a, like a great concept that just kind of totally goes to the wayside. And then also, I think that the jokes, a lot of the dated material does spoil it on the rewatch, and I think will ultimately rob it of any remnants of its legacy, where it would be very hard to show Mystery Men to my Gen Z nieces and nephews and nibblings. Like, I don't think that there's any amount of explanation of, like, you know, in the late 90s, we were just bigoted and we didn't know, you know, like, there's just really no getting around it. And I think it's going to be hard for our generation going forward, trying to pass on some of our favorite, most nostalgic films to the next generation without going like,
yeah,
I'm
but Lisa,
sorry.
That's not going to be Mystery Men. Yeah. Like, I don't know who, there aren't a lot of people who are going to be like really apologetic about the Mystery Men.
But the concept of this program, right, is are we blinded by our nostalgia, or is this a quality film that will stand the test of time? I'm saying, as a person who watched this for the first time, who does have nostalgia for the 90s, but doesn't have nostalgia for this film, I don't think it's going to stand up. I just don't think it does.
No, that's fair.
But like I said, 60, that's a 60% of goodness. It's only 40% of badness.
Okay.
But mathematically, it stands.
Having only just watched this movie, I think your opinion on whether it holds up or not is invalid. So we'll go to my more valid opinion as a person who watched it in the theater. The only one amongst you who did.
You stood up for it.
Yeah, loved it, adored it, was a real big hipster about it. Revisiting it, yeah, yikes on a lot of things. And like, you know, sure, problematic stuff, absolutely. I can't really argue on that. But also, just tonally, it's all over the place. I think the filmmakers were at war with what they wanted this movie to be, so it fails on achieving something memorable or significant anyway, right? I think a 6 out of 10, 60%, I think that works for me. I think, though, you know, listen to that one reviewer talk about how maybe another cast could have, you know, really made something, you know, I'm using significant and memorable again, but something tangible. Yeah, okay, that's not a word either. But hey, there was not another cast that could have done better than the cast that we got here. I think that Ben Stiller, Janine Garofalo, William H. Macy, you know, Kel Mitchell, Paul Rubens, Wes Studi, Hank Azaria, Greg Kinnear, Jeffrey Rush, Eddie Izzard, Artie Lang, who am I missing? Tom Waits. I think they all kill it given what they have.
I think this is literally a case of something turning out to be significantly less than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
Where it's just like, I think it's a big whiff, but I do think in the swing there is artistry.
There is beauty in the swing.
Yeah.
Oh, because I know that watching it, there are definitely some scenes that I can tell just by the way that they were filmed, they give me a feeling of uneasiness. But then there's some scenes where it's, you know, it's supposed to be upbeat and light. And so I agree completely with you where tonally, I don't think they knew exactly what they were going for and just didn't quite have the follow through with what they set up. They set up something that was so potentially great, but then just, it doesn't quite have the follow through that it should. You know, it just,
I do think, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm going to keep on going anyway. you have to remember, like, in 1999, so like, superhero cinema really kicked off with, you know, 1978 Superman, Richard Donner's Superman, and then like went into high gear with Tim Burton's Batman in 89. Mm-hmm. And then we had like the Batman franchise in the 90s, and then we had all these other films trying to do what Batman did with things like The Rocketeer and Dick Tracy and, you know, Ninja Turtles and all that cool stuff.
Yeah.
So like, I cinematically, Hollywood, they didn't quite know how to spoof a superhero story. And I think that's a big problem with Mystery Men, is that they are trying to be Batman and satirize Batman and failing at both. Mm. I think if you made an attempt like this today, you'd have a lot more success. Hence The Boys.
Yeah. They're trying to be Tim Burton Batman and Adam West Batman at the same time.
Yeah.
In a way. And it's a recipe that does not work together. Colin, it's your first viewing of the movie. What about you? What did you think of Mystery Men?
I mean, I would agree with Brad's like last statement. That's kind of where, as I was reading all these reviews, the big thing that comes up a lot is that this movie is like ahead of its time,
and that it's like meant to be like a superhero satire, but it was kind of like pre the big superhero boom. Like just a year later, you have X-Men come out, which kind of like changes everything going forwards. And everything that like, yeah, Superman was 1978, but and then Superman 2 was good, but like Superman 3 and 4 are terrible.
We don't speak of those.
Batman Returns are good. Batman Forever, Batman Robin are bad. They're already like parodies of themselves. And I feel like for me watching Mystery Men is I couldn't decide, and I was trying to figure out, did they know at the time that they were trying to do a spoof?
Yeah.
Because it doesn't really seem like it. It seems like they were just kind of in the vein, but wanted to make a comedy.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily seem like, other than the fact that they borrowed sets from those Batman movies, that they were necessarily trying to satirize the comic book movies of that era. Mm-hmm. But I think there's still like a lot of potential. Like I think I would have loved to see the same cast like pulled forth to now, especially in like a post like as I watched the movie, I just kept thinking like this could have been Tropic Thunder.
Yeah.
Like I love Tropic Thunder, and I feel like there's potential for this movie to do that for the superhero genre if it came after the MCU and the DC extended universe and you actually had a lot of, I don't know, tropes to pull from.
Yeah.
Of that and exploit and make fun of. But I don't know, I agree with you guys. I think as a movie there's a lot of potential. I think everybody puts on a good performance except for Hank Azaria. I wasn't really a big fan of Blue Raja at all.
I was a fan of him out of the costume. Like his stuff with Mom, yeah. You gotta knock first. You know, being like this adult teenage boy. That stuff with Hank Azaria I liked, but all the other stuff, I agree that I wasn't a fan of those either.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say it's like a 60% movie for sure. I think that's fair.
Yeah. And I think I agree with everyone as well. Like, I didn't say a number before, but yeah, 60%. It was what it was. It was enjoyable. I don't hate that I had to sit through it again or anything like that. It has some great moments, but overall, it's not going to go down in even my top 30 of superhero movies of all time. You know, so
I was kind of wondering the whole time if the story could have been made better by us not knowing that Captain Amazing let Frank Castle Frankenstein, like that he wasn't the one who let him out. I felt like I wanted Captain Amazing to actually be a true bad guy by the end of it, and he kind of just doesn't.
Yeah, he gets turned inside out and goodbye Captain Amazing. So
I think that like there are so many good movies in this movie.
Yeah.
They didn't pick one.
Yeah, for sure.
So, like I think the Captain Amazing film where he ends up charred at the end could be a great movie.
To me, the film is such an interesting oddity, and its failure makes it watchable. So, like, if you go into Mystery Men with the arc of superhero cinema in your head, I think it makes for a fascinating watch. And I had a great time watching it, and I had a great time talking about it with you guys. And I would recommend other nerds like us who have not yet experienced Mystery Men to just take their, you know, their pickaxe and go into this excavation that is this film to try to understand how it came to be and why it doesn't work. Like, so I'm not going to go like, I'm going to banish this film into the nether realm and never watch it again. I think it has a place amongst this genre.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, I would recommend it for sure to anybody who likes the movies I like and grew up like at a similar time as me. I think having loved so much the Schumacher Batman movies when I was 10 years old, and like, I remember like getting these holographic cards off cereal boxes and collecting them all.
I collected Marvel cards. I remember Marvel cards.
And so I think having that immediately pulled me into this movie because I was like, oh, it looks like what I remember from that era.
And I think a lot of people our age who were into Batman Forever and Batman and Robin didn't go to see Mystery Men.
Yeah.
And I think this movie would blow some minds with just the Batman Forever set set comparisons.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, with the amount of superhero content that is available these days between The Boys and what's that one on Netflix with the
Jupiter's Legacy, but
the one with Elliot Page.
Oh, the Umbrella Academy.
The Umbrella Academy, you know, Titans, like, and then of course all the CW stuff. Like, there's just so much superhero content that the idea of being able to say to someone, "Oh, well, have you seen Mystery Men?" Oh, okay, there you go. Go check out Mystery Men, because we've already consumed all this other content that, here's one you might not have heard of. It's kind of like Spawn. You might not have heard of it. Or Meteor Man. Might not have heard of it.
Oh, yeah, Meteor Man. Yeah.
Well, there we go. That is Mystery Men, and that's our show for this week. A big, huge thank you to our guests, Brad and Lisa Gullickson, all the way from the Eastern United States, joining us in Western Canada. Give us your rundown. Give us your handles. As you say in your show, where can people send their words of affirmation to you?
Yeah. Well, you can find me on all social medias at MouthDork. And of course, you can find the podcast at CBCC Podcast and at comicbookcouplescounseling.com. You can also find me writing weekly at Film School Rejects. And in fact, if you are in a 90s comic book kind of headspace, I once wrote an article called From Ninja Turtles to Blade, How the 90s Radicalized the Comic Book Industry.
Nice.
And Mystery Men is featured toward the end of that article.
Okay.
So give that a look-see. Give me some clicks. But Lisa, where can these lovely listeners send their words of affirmation to you?
I am always accepting words of affirmation on Twitter and Instagram at Sidewalk Siren. And if you go onto my Instagram right now, I do have a picture I drew that I'm pretty proud of MODOK locking his dog past Captain America's mailbox. And I'm pretty proud of it.
Yeah. Patton Oswalt retweeted it.
He did.
Nice.
I pulled up that article on the 90s comic book era.
Yeah.
And there's a line that I wrote about Mystery Men. And I wrote, Mystery Men is The Boys minus the NC-17 attitude.
Oh, okay. Okay, Brad in the past.
Brad in the past.
We've got a new tagline. Absolutely. There, that's beautiful. Well, thank you. We appreciate so much for you guys being here. And, you know, if you're listening to this show and you only tuned in because Brad and Lisa are here, you know, try another episode. Come on, give us a listen. Give us some love too. You know, just avoid the first few episodes. They're good after you've listened to current episodes.
Here's my last sentence on the Mystery Men in my Film School Rejects article. Mystery Men lays a lot of eggs on its road to comedy, but a few hatch into guffaws, satisfying enough to keep the runtime enjoyable.
It sounds like someone doing an impersonation of Brad. It's so funny.
I wrote that 2 years ago? Yeah, 2019, August 15th, 2019.
That's awesome. Well, if you like that show, one thing you can do to really help us out on the business end is to, well, tell your friends, share our posts. Word of mouth is the lifeblood of a podcast trying to get noticed in that huge sea of podcasts out there. We are the official rival of Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, and we need all of you to tell your friends and get our numbers up so that we can rise up and overtake Conan. Or another way you can do that is to go to whatever app it is you listen to your podcast on. Give us 5 stars, a little review. It doesn't matter what you say. It's not for our egos, but those 5 stars, they just drive you up the charts and they help us get noticed.
And be sure to check out our website, www.iuselectthisone.com. There you can find links to all of our podcast episodes as well as our social media. We have Facebook, we have Instagram, we have Twitter. Go on there, give us some likes, give us some comments, give us some shares. Email us at iuselectthisone, all one word, @gmail.com, and let us know what movies you used to like, and then maybe you'll find us talking about them on the show.
And if you would like to be a producer of the show and donate to us and get a shout out just like Josh Blum, our executive producer, you can go to patreon.com/iusedtolikethisone and become part of our Patreon community. I Used to Like This One is created by, hosted by, and produced by Sean Wells and Colin Stewart. It is edited by Sean Wells, music by Lyndon Carter. Look for his band Carter and the Capitals anywhere you listen to music. Thanks for listening, and join us next week when we take a look at another movie on I Used to Like This One.